It sank in about 3 minutes, broke in half. That woke us up, that it wasn't a quiet picnic that we were going on. It was serious.
It's 80 years since D-Day. British, American and Canadian forces attacked German troops on beaches in Normandy in 1944 in what was the largest seaborne invasion in history. It was a crucial turning point in the Second World War, which led to victory in Europe the following year. Reporter Rhys Griffiths has been speaking to John Roberts from Whitstable, who was a 20-year-old Royal Navy officer on board destroyer HMS Serapis at the time of Operation Overlord. He's been describing his role at that time.
We all knew there was going to be a D-Day of some sort. The war couldn't end without us invading Europe and defeating the Nazis. But we didn't know when or where. But we did some practice bombarding with an army officer spotting for us. And then at the beginning of June, we went down to Portsmouth, and there were 40 destroyers down there. I'd never seen more than about 10 at once. To see 40 all in one place was amazing. And it was also amazing that there were 40 destroyers, but there were probably 500 ships altogether, and we were not attacked in any way. The security had been wonderful, both as security anyway, and also because we'd misled the Germans into thinking we might be going to invade up here, Dover to Calais, or we might invade the other side of the Thames. We kept Hitler guessing as to where we would land.
It was a remarkably successful deception, wasn't it? Incredible, because I think it was the US First Army group that they invented to consider. I think George Patton was nominally...
He pretended he had
an army group in, yes, in Kent.
Yes.
Incredible. I think Shepperton Film Studios were making mock tanks. And
that's right.
All this incredible, remarkable deception. I think even they were intercepting signals that the high command of the Wehrmacht was still saying, no, it's a feint, they'll be coming across
that's
the channel,
right,
to the Bar de Calais. And the more you think about Overlord and the scale of that operation, the more it staggers you about what a feat of planning and preparation it was to pull off.
I always thought it was very sad that the Admiral, Vice Admiral Russell, he planned Dunkirk. He was in Dover and he planned Dunkirk, and that really was a miracle too. And it was he who planned the naval side of Overlord. And sadly, he was killed in an aircraft crash about 2 weeks after D-Day. I think of all the senior people who deserved to be rewarded, it was him.
And perhaps a name that maybe, yes, has been written out of the history a little bit in
how
we tell about it, because maybe with D-Day, we talk a lot about the soldiers onto the beaches, but it wasn't a lot, had to work across the entire scope of an incredibly large theatre to bring that to,
yes,
to happen.
I've been interviewed by two German organisations, they're sort of news organisations, and both times it was a woman questioning me, and one of them said, while we were going across on the night before the landings, did I think we were not going to win? And I'd never really thought about that before. But I said, quite apart from all the deception, we were very lucky that because of the storm, Rommel didn't think we could possibly begin to come across, and he'd gone back to have his birthday with his wife. Hitler was asleep and nobody dared wake him up, and because Hitler thought we might be going to come here, two or three of the panzer divisions were up here instead of in Normandy.
Yeah.
And that meant that we had about 48 hours start.
And so when did you arrive then in Portsmouth? How many days before D-Day?
We arrived, I think it was about 4 days before. It's not really part of the landing history, but I was, my job's in the ship. When I did the technical courses after the Renown, I was invited to say how I wanted to specialise. Did I want to become a specialist gunnery officer or torpedo officer or what? And amongst, we were all 19, and the rumour was that if they couldn't grant you what you wanted, you were press-ganged into submarines. And that was the last thing I wanted. So I put down that I wanted to specialise in anti-submarine. And that's what I became, an anti-submarine officer, dealing with ASDICs and sonar. And I was the sonar officer in Serapis. But also in harbour, I ran the ship's office, which included paying the sailors. And while we were at Spithead, nobody was allowed out of the ship except me, and I was allowed to go ashore and collect pay because we were going to be away during a pay day, and if I didn't get it before we went, if we were sunk, they might not get it. So I went ashore, I came back with the pay, and I had an assistant, and we counted out all the money, and we discovered at the end that we had £500 too much. The paymaster had given us an extra £500 in a wad. Well, I wasn't allowed to go ashore and hand it back, and I couldn't communicate with him. So it was about a week later when we went back to Portsmouth for something, that on the jetty was a very white-faced paymaster ready to ask, did I have £500 too much?
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah. That's a large sum of money in 1944.
It was then.
Yeah, and so...
So we were there about five days, and at night there were one or two sort of half air raids, but no damage was ever done to anybody. And then, of course, the gale blew up the day before D-Day should have been, then luckily... There was a slight break in the chain of wet weather coming across, and Eisenhower was brave enough to take the plunge and say, let's go.
And for yourself, I mean, it was, I guess, in terms of the secrecy, did you realise when you sailed to Portsmouth that this was what was about to happen? Or was it still at that stage very... The mission wasn't communicated, because the secrecy was incredible, obviously, around.
It was. Well, we had none of us, not even the captain, knew where the invasion was going to be. I mean, we all knew, and we'd known for ages, that there was going to be an invasion of France. But we didn't know until, I think it was the morning of the 5th, when the captain was told he could open the envelope with all the instructions for our ship. And we actually got underway about 6 hours later. And our job was to lead. We actually led the Armada, because during the years before, as well as building what they called the Atlantic Wall, which was from Norway down to Spain, the Germans had sown 50,000 mines in the channel, and it was virtually impossible to go across without minesweepers going first. Minesweepers don't have much of a gun, and the Germans had destroyers in Le Havre and in Cherbourg, and to protect them if they did come out, we led the way behind the minesweepers so that we could protect them if the Germans came out. And I said in the account that I wrote afterwards, crossing the channel, there were, I think, about 25 minesweepers ahead of us, and they go quite slowly, about 10 knots, and we, that was very slow for us. We were just following them, and it was quiet, and you could hear the sea lapping against the ship's side, and every now and again you heard a plop in the water, and it was a minesweeper putting a buoy in the sea for the ships behind, to, you know, for them to follow. And we got to about 6 or 7 miles from the French coast by 5 o'clock in the morning, and suddenly there was a loud bang, and it was a destroyer that was next to us, about 1,000 yards on our port side. It had been torpedoed by a German fast patrol boat, which hadn't come out for us. They used to come out every night anyway, in case there was something there, and to their surprise, they saw all these ships. So they fired off their torpedoes, and one of them hit the destroyer next to us, which I always thought was rather sad. It was manned by Norwegians, Norwegians who'd escaped from Norway during the war. With that being sunk, it sank in about 3 minutes, broke in half. That woke us up, that it wasn't a quiet picnic that we were going on. It was serious. And we waited a little bit then, because the minesweepers that came first were largish ones, where the water was deep enough for them. But as we got within about 6 miles of the coast, the water was shallow, and so we had to have smaller minesweepers to take us in to 3 miles from the coast, which was where we stopped and from where we did our bombarding.
And so what was the role of Sepphoris? I understand, yes, it was to, I guess, provide that quite heavy fire to positions to help support and suppress the German defence of the coast?
Yes, of course, with our reconnaissance and also the information that the French resistance had been sending across, we had information as to where all the German defences were, you know, their battery guns and things like that. And there were three battleships out to sea from us, and then there were about 8 or 10 cruisers with the next size guns in between the battleships and us, and then there was us with our guns. And from about 6:30 onwards, we started firing at the at these targets. The noise was terrific. And then at about 7:15, I think it was, a whole lot of aircraft, including 300 or 400 Flying Fortresses, flew. They flew along the beach. They didn't fly across it, because they'd only be going off on one part. They went along it, and all the way along, they were dropping 500-pound bombs. So all the German defences were being destroyed in that last half hour or so before the soldiers landed. And then there were rocket ships, or rocket vessels, rather like you normally see the Russians using. They had about 25 rockets, and they'd be about 1 mile off the coast, and they'd fire the 25 rockets, which would all go swoosh and then come down on the beach, all ahead of the soldiers landing.
It's a remarkable coordination, another thing, isn't it?
Yes. Another thing that one of the Germans asked me, they said, have you ever thought as to how remarkable the coordination of everything was? I mean, it was 150,000 human beings, and yet they were ordered to, the plan never wavered. And I think on the program last night, some people said, we were on the beach, we knew where we were, we knew where we had to go. Everything was on the plan, and it worked perfectly. And the Germans, who normally plan things well themselves, they admired us for how well we did it.
Yeah, I mean, with hindsight, you look back and you think, well, it worked. It was, you almost think that history has an inevitability about it, but it doesn't. There's nothing inevitable in anything we do. And it is incredible because it's the smallest, one part of that great machine breaks down and then the next thing and the next thing. And it could have been, it wasn't preordained that it was going to be a success, but it proved to be so.
I think we were lucky on our gold, which was our beach. The shore was fairly low. It wasn't like the American beach, which had cliffs they had to go up. I think, I don't know whether they thought about it, but I think we had the best beach to land on, and that's why everything went like clockwork. But I think at the American end, there were quite a lot of errors. Sometimes there were some tanks, I think, which were supposed to land in water so deep, but not deeper, and they were put into the water when it was too deep, and they just sank with the crews inside them.
Given the scale of the operation and the Germans would be firing, you're bombarding the shore there, did you think in that moment or maybe afterwards about the men who were landing on the beaches and what they must have been experiencing in that moment?
I think we were 3 miles off the beach, so the small landing craft that they'd been put in to actually land, they came past us. So we cheered them and waved them on. And I'm sure all of us, felt, thank goodness I'm not one of them. And it was about 11 o'clock in the morning when one or two boats started coming back with wounded people, because there weren't the facilities on shore immediately. And we had a sick bay and we had a doctor on board. So we got about a dozen soldiers who'd been badly wounded. But we kept on firing. We went on firing till about 11 o'clock, and by then we'd used almost half the amount of ammunition that we had in the ship. So we didn't want to run out, so we slowed down then. But our main job, having fired at the targets that we knew about, there was an army officer on shore, and he was in contact with us by radio. And whenever he came across a group of soldiers or tanks or guns, he contacted us and said, there's a target here. And he said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And we knew where that was relative to where we were. And we fired about 25 rounds at it. And then, with luck, he came back and said, well done, you've destroyed them.
And you stayed, and that was, you said 11 o'clock, I assume, was that 11 a.m.?
Yeah.
And so were you, how long were you at sea then, supporting the landing?
Well, we were supporting the landing, as it were, supporting the army on shore, for about 3 or 4 days. Mm. And by then, the army had got far enough inland for our guns not to reach them. So for the next 8 or 9 days, our job was at night to stop the German destroyers from Le Havre coming out and attacking the supply ships. Because there was that thing, the Mulberry Harbour, which was artificially built and everything. If the Germans could have destroyed that, that would have made a big difference. So our job was to make sure the Germans never got that far. And in fact, there were about 20 or so of our destroyers doing that, and the Germans never achieved anything.